Welcome back to episode 139 of the Women of Marvel podcast, where we assemble to chat everything Marvel and more. Today's episode is brought to you by Loot Crate. Hello, everyone. This is Judy Stevens, producer.
And this is Sana Mana, director of content development.
Today, we're bringing you a very special podcast highlighting women working in comics and the history of comics for women. In today's Women's History Month special, we have a packed-filled podcast, including interviews with Trina Robbins, the comic historian, and Greg Young of the Bowery Boys. Plus, we'll be sprinkling in little audio snippets from Marvel creators and cast about the importance of women in the comics and entertainment industry. First up, we're really excited. We got to chat to Trina Robbins, and Sana, I'll kick it off.
So I'm excited. I was really excited about talking to Trina because obviously we don't know where we're going if we don't know where we came from. So I'm always interested in hearing about like what has happened in the history of comics, sort of the role of women in comics, because, you know, that one belief that there hasn't been women working in the industry is complete BS. You can bleep that out if you want, Judy.
It's so false.
It's so false. It's so wrong. And so we wanted to highlight that. So as always, this is going to be a celebration of all of the things and all of the accomplishments that women have done in comics over the years. And Trina Robbins, in particular, is arguably one of the most iconic women cartoonists and creators in the comics industry. She's known for her contributions and influence during the underground comics movement in the 70s, along with, her lifelong work of creating outlets for and promoting female comics creators. Besides curating and editing the longest-running all-women anthology of comic books known as Women's Comics, that's W-I-M-M-E-N apostrophe S, I love that spelling, Trina Robbins also owns the largest collection of original comic art by 20th century women cartoonists, which actually went on tour at a feminist comics symposium in Israel. So when she's not touring and promoting female comics creators, she's at home actually writing nonfiction books, preserving the history of women's contributions to the comics industry, and you should check some of those books out. She's done something called Babes in Arms, which is a collection of World War II era comics by women creators. A Minion Yid, it's an adaptation of short stories by actually Trina Robbins' father, and Dope, it's an adaptation of the Sax Rohmer novel that Robbins had previously serialized for a magazine she worked for, which is called Eclipse Magazine. So very, very excited. She's very intelligible, very knowledgeable, and hopefully you guys will enjoy this great conversation we had with her.
Let's start at the beginning. What attracted you to comics?
I was reading comics since I was very young. My mother was a school teacher, a second grade school teacher, and when I was four, she decided that I was ready to read, and she taught me to read when I was four, and I totally took to it. I mean, aside from the fact that she also gave birth to me, teaching me to read was the greatest gift I've ever gotten. Life, of course, comes first, then comes learning to read, and I just took to reading, and I read everything. So it was kind of natural that I would also read comics. And in those days, I think still there are parents who are a little worried about kids reading comics, thinking it means they won't read anything else. But of course, I read everything. So there was no problem ever with me reading comics.
So, I mean, at the time that you started reading comics, what was the environment like, right? It was far more, I guess, mainstream and accessible to pick up a comic book. Whereas now everyone's like, where's the local comic shop? How do I find it? What was the climate like back then?
No, you could get comics in the corner candy store, which was where I got my comics. I had to cross two streets to get to the corner candy store, which meant that I had to be old enough to cross the streets myself. But aside from that, you know, as soon as I could cross the streets and not get run over, I would just go to my corner candy store, and they had a spinner rack, you know, the one that says, "Hey, kids, comics," and that's where I got my comics.
And what was the comic? What was the first thing that got you excited, that got you hooked?
Well, the earliest comics I read, actually, my mother bought for me. Mm-hmm. And they were, I think the publisher is Gold Key. And they did a lot of comics for kids that my mother really approved of as a school teacher. Because most of the comics, as you know, they're lettered all in caps. And my mother was really happy with Gold Key because they did comics that were lettered with caps and then small letters, you know, correctly for a teacher. And they would be like our gang comics. And when I was very young, I was a real Raggedy Ann fan. Mm-hmm. There were Raggedy Ann comics, Raggedy Ann and Andy comics. And, of course, the Funny Animal comics. They were all the ones that were okay for kids. But once I started buying my own, I really bought any comic that, you know, within limits because of my pathetic little allowance, but any comic that featured a girl on the cover or a woman on the cover who was in a position of power, not somebody just being rescued by a guy, but like the girl or woman was the star of the comic, and those were the ones I bought.
I mean, that's so interesting. It's like it's a very innate desire that apparently starts at a very, very young age, right? Like, were you conscious of what you were doing, or you just sort of gravitated
to it? No, this was what I was attracted to. Yeah. If it was girls, I was interested. If it was guys in costumes rescuing girls, I was not interested.
That's interesting. So, you know, well, let's talk a little bit about, you know, you fast-forwarding and deciding you wanted to do a career in comics. You started working at East Village Other, right?
Yes.
And then from there, you started this first all-woman comic book, It Ain't Me, Babe Comics.
That was 1970.
Yeah.
My first comic was published in the East Village Other in 66, so it was 4 years later that I produced It Ain't Me, Babe, first all-woman comic, yes.
So can you talk about that experience? Like, what was, you know, where did that come from? What was your intention? How did people respond?
Well, I had come to San Francisco in December 69, almost 1970, and I'd gone to San Francisco from New York because it was like that was the happening place. You know, not just if you go to San Francisco, wear flowers in your hair, but it was kind of where underground comics were coming from, even though we were doing them in New York, too. And it just seemed like the place to go. But when I got there, I discovered that there was indeed a huge underground comic scene. I mean, for the time. But it was all guys, and they were not interested in me. I mean, literally, you know, no one ever said, "Go away, we hate you," or anything like that. But they just didn't invite me into their scene. They didn't invite me to their parties. They didn't invite me into their comics. I mean, they just ignored me. So then somebody showed a copy of It Ain't Me, Babe, which was the first women's liberation newspaper in the country. And I went, whoa, that's for me. And phoned them up and met them a couple of days later at a B-in in Golden Gate Park. And soon I was drawing for them. I was drawing their covers. I was drawing a comic in the back cover. I would do spot illustrations. And because I had, like, their moral support, not their financial support because nobody had any money, but their moral support, which was the really important thing, I felt I could put together an all-woman comic book, and that's what I did.
So do you think that there was, I mean, how much did you internalize the fact that there was this boys' club that you were not invited to and that you wanted to sort of work against this? Was that on your mind at all, or were you just sort of like, that's the world?
Mm. Of course it was.
So you feel like this was a bit of a victory for you to kind of create your own space and create awareness. How did people respond to
work? Well, of course, as usual, mm-hmm. the women loved it. I didn't get much response from the men. I did get some. I ran into Rick Griffin, who is alas no longer with us, but he was a Zap cartoonist, and he was a poster, rock and roll poster artist, and a really, really nice guy. I ran into him shortly after the book came out, and he told me, he congratulated me on it, which was very nice. But for the most part, I didn't get reactions from the men. But it sold in feminist bookstores, women's liberation bookstores, and women, you know, they loved it. I got fan mail because, gosh, a comic for women was a first.
Right, right, right. Yeah, that's a big deal.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, so fast forward a little bit, and you come to Marvel. Marvel's imprint, the Star Comics, in the mid-80s, and you create Misty, which was a comic aimed at a young girl audience. You know, but you mentioned it didn't necessarily take off a very long time, but that women still appreciated it.
Girls, especially. We had some guys. You know, what's interesting, of course, was with that kind of comic where you design your own clothes, and it's very kind of female-oriented. Gay guys loved it. You know, the same kind of, you know, Katie Keene back in the 50s had a lot of gay male readers. Same thing. Gay, young gay men, boys read it. And it wasn't, and I, you know, some of them were really good designers, and I'd feature their designs in the book. And it wasn't until years later that some of them emailed me and said, you know, your book really helped me because I'm gay and I was just a kid then. And it was like, you know, I'm shocked. Of course I knew they had to be gay if they liked my book. And then, of course, all the girls who liked it because there was nothing else out there for girls.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So for this comic, did you approach Marvel or did Marvel approach you to build this?
I approached Jim Shooter at a convention and told him what I would like to do. And then I sent him, he was interested, so I sent him a proposal. Jim Shooter told me that he had gotten his start at Marvel writing Millie the Model scripts.
Right.
Yeah, so he related to what I was doing.
So what do you think, I mean, you know, there is this conversation that people are having, have been having, is like, oh, women don't read comics, women, girls don't read comics, whatever. And meanwhile, you've been on the scene attempting to create this content for girls, putting it out there and realizing that there are girls reading comics.
Of course.
What do you think the disconnect is? Like, why is it that there's this perception out there, even though there is some content? I mean, do you think that there's too much gatekeeping, that there's men doing the gatekeeping, that it doesn't necessarily benefit to invest in girls' content? Like, what, you know, from your experience, what do you think happened from then to now?
Well, you know, when they were all saying girls don't read comics, they were suffering from a universal amnesia. You know, none of them, and these guys were old enough to remember that there was a time when there were all those girls' comics.
Yeah.
You know, they remembered, they should have remembered, you know, Millie the Model and Patsy Walker and Katie Keene, all those girls' comics. I mean, Jim Shooter remembered, for God's sakes. They should have remembered, too. But they had this, like I say, universal amnesia. You know, they shut it out of their minds. And all they could see was what was happening at that very moment. Mm-hmm. When they said girls and women don't read comics, what they really meant is girls don't read comics because we're not interested in comics with guys with big jaws and thick necks punching each other out.
Yeah.
But when there are comics that girls like to read, girls read comics. And of course, what changed all that was manga. You know, along comes manga. And you go into any bookstore, you know, the chain bookstores at the time, and you've got these teenage girls and adolescent girls sitting there in the manga section, surrounded by manga and reading them. Of course girls read comics when there's comics like manga that girls like to read.
So what happened in that shift where, you know, there were so many comics for girls in the sense that there were, you know, female leads, women on covers, things like that. And then at some point it became very male dominated. And you're talking about this universal amnesia and people forgetting that there was all this content that girls actually do want to read comics. Like, why, you know, what happened where they're just not creating that? They just suddenly stopped creating that content. You know, was there just no desire? Was there just, just kind of navel gazing to an extent? Like, what do you think happened there?
Well, I think it started in the early 60s when DC was the start. They started having, you know, there had been a real slump because of the comics code, and a lot of books just, a lot of comic publishers just ceased publication. But there were still those love comics and those teen comics. And DC discovered that their super teams were doing really well. And Marvel saw that DC's super team comics were doing well. So Stan Lee came up with, you know, along with Jack Kirby and along with Steve Ditko, the artists he worked with, came up with first the Fantastic Four and the X-Men, which were different from any comics they'd been publishing before, and then came up with, you know, really successful superhero titles that really caught on because for the time they were unusual. And that was like Spider-Man, you know, a high school kid who's a superhero and has to mend his suit himself, sew it up when it breaks and when it rips, or Thor, who, you know, is a god, or Doctor Strange, who I really loved, you know, because he was so mystic. So they came up with these, and suddenly their superhero titles took off. And so, to the detriment of the girl titles that they'd been publishing, they started concentrating completely on their superhero titles.
Mm.
And Millie the Model still survived for a while, I think till about the early 70s, really. Same with Patsy Wilka. Patsy Wilka died earlier, sometime in the 60s. The end of romance comics, the last few were published in the very early 70s, and they just phased out anything for girls to, you know, to the advantage of the superhero comics, which is what they pushed. And at a certain point, it was all so male that the guys in control, and I'm not talking about people like Stan Lee, you know, who'd been there from the beginning, but these younger guys who were now doing the comics had been fans 10 years earlier when they were younger of these superhero comics. And now that was all they wanted. Mm-hmm. They didn't want any girl comics. They just wanted superhero comics because that was what they had loved when they were kids.
Do you think, you know, sort of taking like a broader idea of that climate and the time that, like, you know, men came back from war during World War II and women were suddenly working, do you think that was sort of a backlash on women suddenly having apartments?
No, really was because women were still doing teen comics, and romance comics took off like mad after the war. So there was a backlash because during the war there had been these really wonderful action heroines. That I have a book, by the way, it's a good time to mention it. I have a book coming out later this year called Babes in Arms, and it collects the work of four women cartoonists who worked in the golden age of comics during the war and who drew comics that starred these strong, beautiful, courageous heroines who fought the Axis. But after the war, it all disappeared, and women were indeed sent back to the kitchens, but they were still drawing the teen comics and the romance comics, which started in 1947. So that was the backlash, really. And those comics did fabulously until, really, the Comics Code and until Marvel and DC retooled and just aimed at superhero books.
Well, a lot of your work has been centering around bringing these 20th century female cartoonists to light. I mean, when did that become a thing that you were like, I need to do this? This needs to be a thing that's important.
Well, because, you know, all the people who, they didn't just say girls and women don't read comics, they said women had never drawn comics. And I knew that was not true. And, you know, here's all these women who were incredibly, like Nell Brinkley, who was such a superstar in her day that girls collected her work and pasted them in scrapbooks, and the younger girls colored in the drawings, and, you know, she made newspaper headlines wherever she went. She was such a superstar, but she was forgotten because when the guys were writing histories of comics, and that's a comparatively recent thing. I mean, history of comics really started around the 70s, you know? Mm-hmm. And when they were writing histories of comics, they only wanted to write about, you know, the Hulk and Spider-Man. They weren't interested in some woman who had drawn gorgeous pictures and wonderful stories in the early 20th century. So they didn't write about these women. So, you know, my big discovery, and really in all my research, is if you're not written about, you're forgotten.
How'd you go about doing your research?
Well, the earliest was not easy. That was, you know, in the pre-computer days, the first book on history of women cartoonists I wrote, I co-wrote with Catherine Ironwood, possible for a woman to get an abortion. And, of course, the Trump administration is going to make it even more impossible. That's what they're trying for. So this book was called Choices, and it was a benefit for the National Organization for Women, NOW, and we made a lot of money for them, and I'm very proud of that. I edited the book and co-published it with Liz Schiller, who at the time was the treasurer of Oakland NOW, and we worked very closely with San Francisco NOW, because that's where I live, in putting the book out. So I'm very proud of both of those books.
That's fantastic. That's absolutely fantastic.
I mean, it's amazing to hear about, you know, that was almost 30 years ago, you know, stepping up and doing this. And now we look at people doing like Kickstarters and stuff like that. But you guys were the forefront of using comics to have a message. And that's amazing.
So let's talk a little bit about the books you're currently working on. You talked about Babes in Arms. You have something called, you have a book called Dope coming out. You want to talk?
Yes.
Yeah. You want to talk a little bit about that and any other books that you want to talk? Seems like you're very busy.
I know it's really bizarre. Yeah. I can't believe it myself, but I have 4 books coming out this year.
That's fantastic.
I mean, I do have a very strong Judeo-Christian work ethic, which is that I always have to be producing something. But even for me, 4 books is a bit excessive.
So why don't you talk about that, or talk about whatever ones you'd like to highlight?
Okay, well, I talked about Babes in Arms. Dope is, of course, I mentioned Eclipse before. They were really, you know, I don't know if they were the best, but they were certainly one of the best of the black and white publishers of the 80s. Mm-hmm. And they put out a magazine called Eclipse Magazine, which was a comic magazine. And for that, I was reprinting it. I was serializing a 1919 book by Sax Rohmer. If you've never heard of him, he was a pulp writer, immensely famous and successful. He created Fu Manchu. People usually know the name Fu Manchu. And Dope is just, it's just so blood and thunder. I love it. And also very stylish. Mm-hmm. Something about 1919. And I did a lot of, by the way, fashion research on that. So everyone is dressed correctly, which, you know, I couldn't help but notice that a lot of books that the guys do, you know, they have no idea how women really dress or how women used to dress.
Right.
You know, they if it's long ago, they put her in a long skirt. If it's today, they put her in some low-cut, skin-tight, short thing. But they don't really look at how women actually dress or dressed. So I had a lot of fun with that. It was serialized in Eclipse Magazine, and so Drew Ford of the publisher of It's Alive Publications, mm-hmm. Is reprinting it, has put it all together, and is reprinting it in graphic novel form. And it holds up. I mean, I have weird feelings about some of my early stuff that it's just simply so terrible, I don't want it to be seen. But this one, I went back and I looked at it, and I, you know, when Drew suggested it, and I said, yes, it holds up. It does look good. I was actually, I think, in the middle 80s to the very early 90s, or maybe 1990. That's when my art, I think, was at its best. So it looks good.
Hmm. So, you, I mean, obviously, this amazing career that you've had, that you continue to have. What is your advice to young creators trying to make a mark in their industry? What's the best way to go about it?
Okay, top of the list, meet your deadline.
I love that. That's my favorite.
I'm not kidding. Yeah. I'm very serious.
Yes.
I'm very serious. Sometimes you will see work by an artist, you know, on some comic, and then you'll never see work by that artist again, and you'll think, wow, he or she was so good. Why don't I see any more work by them?
Yeah.
Well, it's because they could not meet their deadlines, and that gets out real fast, and nobody will hire you.
That's a fantastic, as an editor myself, I greatly appreciate that word of advice.
Do you have any, I mean, obviously, like, you know, now the internet has changed the way comics are read, comics are created, you know, like, what sort of has been your experience, what, coming from, like, previously where people actually drew on the boards to now this explosion?
My experience?
Yeah.
Rephrase it. Let's see what you mean.
I mean, sort of like, how has it been for you to sort of watch this happen? I mean, obviously,
incredible. I mean, comics are better than they have ever been, you know? There's still the big-chinned, thick-necked guys beating each other up. You know, there'll always be those, because 12-year-old boys need those comics. But there's so much else now for other people, and it's so well done. And I'm not just talking about women cartoonists, because they're more than ever before, and they're so good. But just comics in general, you know, they're not just girl-friendly, but people-friendly.
Mm-hmm.
So much out there. I mean, the first thing that comes to mind is Paper Girls, which I really love.
I love that.
Is done by two guys.
Yeah.
You know? But it's really people-friendly, and it's girl-friendly, and I love it.
Yeah, and I think a lot of it is because we've raised people's awareness. Like, I think there's a higher level of discourse and dialogue happening in the comics industry, and that need for representation.
And it's all because of the internet.
It's because of the internet, definitely. But I mean, I also think Trina, folks like you as an individual and the work that you've done, you've really been at the forefront of building up that awareness and reminding people of the importance of having that kind of content, those kinds of creators out there. So really, thank you so much for all of your incredible work and for your contributions, because we're feeling it now. We're able to do the work that we do because of what you've laid out before us.
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that, you know, as someone who sort of helped run this podcast for 2 years and been working at Marvel for over 10, that, you know, having there be women that have come before me is important, because sometimes being the first is the hardest part of it all. And looking to people like you that have come before and have fought the battle is great. And so we can then say that to all our listeners at home, that there are people who have been fighting the battle for us to have our voice heard. And that's really important.
Yeah. And it's not so bad now.
No.
It's not so bad now.
We're doing good.
Much better. My God. Marvel was the first, I think, to wise up and start saying, you know, kind of like a light bulb going off over their heads. You know, these publishers and editors saying, you know, we could have 42% more readers if, you know, 52%, I know we have, our population is larger than the male population. If we did comics that appeal to females, why golly, what a great idea.
Yeah.
You know, and they came up with it even before DC, and now DC is also doing girl-friendly comics.
Yeah, no, it's great. It's basic economics, really. Why are we ignoring 50% of the population?
Look at all the money we could make if we sell to girls.
Well, Trina, thank you so much for your time. I know people are going to be very curious as to where they can find you on the internet, other areas, what you're promoting next.
I can be Googled. I have a website, but it's rather out of date.
Okay.
And I have a blog, but I don't, I if I'm lucky, I post the blog every 3 months, so it's kind of pathetic. But I'm on Facebook.
Great.
And, you know, yeah, I can be found. Google me.
And what about your next launch for your books? What can we expect?
Oh, well, when each book comes out, I'm going to be doing signings.
Great.
So, you know, and I will definitely be putting that up on Facebook, announcing what I'm doing and when I'm doing it.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for your time and for speaking with us. This has been really great conversation and very insightful. So those of you out there listening, please go out and check out all of Trina's work, all the things that she's done for the last, 40 years in the industry?
Let's see, starting from 1966, do the math.
Longer, wow. Almost 50, okay. so this is an original woman in comics right here in front of you, and a great way to celebrate Women's History Month, I would say. So thank you again, and hopefully we will have you back on as we have more questions.
I would love it.
Yes, thank you again.
Thank you.
Being a woman in the Marvel Universe right now, in particular in this political climate, feels really important. It means a lot to me. Obviously, also being that's my phone. A woman of that I'm half Chinese, and to be able to have the opportunity to play a character that is strong and smart and so talented and has powers, and to have young girls be able to look up to that, it's so cool, and it's really important. You know, you don't realize how important it is until I go out and I go to conventions and I meet the fans, and, you know, I was in New York a couple months ago, and a little girl came up to me, and she was half Chinese, and she came up to me, and she had tears in her eyes, and she was like, I never felt like I had anyone who looked like me to look up to, and now I do, and now I feel like I can do anything. And that's exactly the power of what Marvel is. You know, she said, because you're not just a superhero, because I've seen you, because it's hard. You know, I think that's what's so beautiful about Marvel is that, and that was kind of the tagline of the beginning, is not all heroes are super, and not all superheroes are super either. I mean, you know, you see such a realistic version of what happens when you have a lot of responsibility, and it's hard. So I think it's so relevant right now, and I'm so proud to be able to be playing this character that represents so much to so many young girls, and it means a lot to me, because I think it's, you know, right now there's no better time to fight like a girl. Right now, it's pretty cool.
Playing a woman in the Marvel Universe, honestly, it feels like I'm just playing a human. And you're allowed to be strong, you're allowed to be flawed, you're allowed to be funny and sassy and intelligent. And I think I have been very spoiled with my main job in America being with Marvel, because it's something that I've never really had to yearn for, to get a good role or get good lines to say or be a part of something that I really believe in. And that's the way I was brought up as well. My mom is a wonderful role model, as were my grandmas and my sister. I'm just surrounded by very strong women and by very strong men who support those very strong women and everything that they want to do, and vice versa. And so, I feel very spoiled. The more you hear about other people's experiences, that I haven't had that experience, makes me just know that it exists, and know that it's possible to be creative and, you know, an actress, and to show vulnerability, and that through that is strength, and then just have some super kick-ass moments. I think it's amazing. So yeah, I now know that exists, and I will demand it in every other job that I get. Assuming that I get any other jobs, in which case this was it. This was fine. I'm fine with that. Really happy to be here.
We're
We're going to take a short pause from the podcast to talk to you a little bit about Loot Crate. So Loot Crate has assembled the Marvel gear and goods crate for the ultimate Marvel fan. This crate's going to feature official Marvel items like collectible home goods, apparel, and more every other month. We've talked about this stuff before, and we really love it. It's all over our desks here at Marvel. So their next box is really exciting. So you just stopped Thanos from undoing reality again, and Nova Prime is probably going to spend weeks on the paperwork alone. So here's an affinity gem of an idea. Let's kick off the space boots and head to the backyard and have a cosmic party. We're inviting a motley crew of galactic greets, and they're bringing essential party items featuring the Guardians of the Galaxy, Captain Marvel herself, and the Nova Corps. I actually know what the Captain Marvel item is, but I have to keep it mum's the word, but you definitely want it. But remember, you only have until 9 p.m. Pacific on May 15th to subscribe. So head over to lootcrate.com/marvelgear and use promo code MARVELWOMAN to save $3 on your subscription today. If you guys want to check out what the first item of the box is, which is a geeky tiki of Yondu himself, head over to Thwip at Marvel's YouTube and you can check out. We made some fun mocktails with it. So while you're listening to this podcast, head over to lootcrate.com/marvelgear. And now, on to our next interview. So the next interview we're really excited about, super fangirl moment for myself. We had Greg Young from the Bowery Boys to come join us. So now Greg Young is one half of the dynamic duo that is the Bowery Boys, which is a podcast that he has been producing along with his best friend Tom Myers since 2007. So that's insane. 10 years of this. Together, Greg and Tom have recorded over 200 episodes of the Bowery Boys, which delves into the history of New York City and has captured the fascination of listeners worldwide. Greg runs the Bowery Boys blog as a source of additional resources for New York aficionados. And in 2006, the duo were awarded a Guys Association of the New York City, the Gansey Award, for outstanding achievement in nonfiction book writing for their book, Bowery Boys, Adventures in Old New York. I actually own the book. I love it. If you guys like history and New York City, you're definitely going to be appreciated. So with no further ado, we welcome Greg to the podcast. Hey guys, we are continuing our Women's History Month special, and we're super excited because we have someone on from another local New York City podcast. We have Greg Young from the Bowery Boys.
Greetings. Hello, guys. Thanks for having me.
So first and foremost, I am incredibly excited to have you on because I listen to the Bowery Boys weekly. I love history, and it's kind of exciting because this is our first time having someone else from another podcast on, and for such a great topic because about a year ago, you did a podcast all about comics and New York City and the superhero.
It was, almost 2 years ago. It was, I would say, like a year and a half ago. And it was about New York's unique relationship with comic books and the industry, because it was an industry that was entirely born, I think I can say, in New York City, and up until the 1970s, most of the major players were born, all the companies were here, and many of the great creators and the iconic, the superheroes and characters are from here.
So let's backtrack for a second, because first of all, again, to echo Judy, thank you so much for being here and for being our token male for this month of our special History Month podcast.
It's my pleasure. As I just gushed earlier about how I'm a big Ms. Marvel fan, in particular, just because it's like she was my entry back into the world of comic books, actually. I had gotten out of them for a few years, and I was like, I want to read some comic books that are a little bit more like, maybe like slightly more interesting and socially aware, and this was one of the first few that, you know, that got me reeled back in.
I love when boys love like girl comics. it makes me so happy.
Well, I want to talk about that a little bit later. The idea of what a quote unquote girl comic was has changed drastically.
Yes, let's get there. So why don't we talk about like your history with comics? Why you wanted to do this podcast in particular, right? Because you guys mostly deal with sort of the history of New York, and where did this idea of doing a special about
comics? It's true that this particular show was quite niche, because we had done shows about industries that had gotten started in New York. Like, the motion picture industry, actually, during the silent era, was very big in New York. Things like radio was also quite big in New York in the 20s and 30s. So we have these industry shows, but I personally, from, like, I currently, back in my apartment in Brooklyn, I have about like 7 or 8 boxes of comic books, and I was a massive comic book fan just growing up, and I even kind of attribute my sort of love of New York City to comic books. I'm not from New York. I was born in Missouri. But my first exposure to New York when I was like 5 or 6, outside of some stray thing on television, was, you know, picking up a Spider-Man comic book.
I was waiting for you to make, I was just making sure it was going to be a Marvel reference, or a DC reference. Well, I was like, what was it?
Those aren't even New York. So.
They aren't. Very, very true, right?
Right. No, I mean, it's like, it's literally like New York, and we can talk about, you know, why New York is so imprinted upon Marvel, but as a result, like, that passed New York on to me a little bit, and so that's my first exposure, and so, you know, when I'm... When Tom is away during the summers, he goes away because he has another job. I will do things that I'm like, okay, this is going to be for me.
You do what you want, yeah. Basically. Yeah.
So, for instance, actually last year I did one called New York and the Rise of the Video Game, or the Birth of the Video Game. It's about that connection with New York, but for comic books, it was a far deeper and richer. Yeah. I mean, I almost feel like that could have been like a mini series. There were so many. I had to just dance past so many things that were so fascinating, you know. I finally got my chance to do that, and I was very honored to be joined on that show by Peter Sanderson, who's a comic historian.
It was a great interview. Yeah,
such a great guy, and just like full of a trillion stories. Yeah. So yeah, that was a. I was really happy with how that turned out.
So is there a favorite, like, superhero that you loved growing up? It's cool if you mention a DC character. I'm okay with it.
I'll mention my DC and then move on to my Marvel.
Okay, great, yeah. Brush past it.
Because, I mean, like... I was clearly a Wonder Woman fan from, like, you know, forever, and, you know, I'm still perhaps the only one of the DC universe that I'm kind of still with a little bit. I was a big, like, mutants junkie, and my favorite comic book, number one comic book by far, was The New Mutants, which was, like, you know, X-Men, but like people that were my age when I was reading it. So, and I was, you know, I'm older than other people in the rooms, but I was during the real great era of The New Mutants. Some of the most beautiful artwork, I think, of like comic books is, I can never pronounce his last name, Bill Sienkiewicz.
Bill Sienkiewicz.
Sienkiewicz.
Yeah, it is. It's a tricky one. Yeah,
but it's like that. It's some of the most stunning art I've ever seen.
Beautiful. Yeah.
So that was really like my favorite. But then obviously, then I got into all the X-Men comic books. And so those are my, like, those are the ones of which I'm closest to. But obviously, like, you know, I collected, like, everything.
Yeah.
You know, I was, like, the kid who went down, you know, I can't remember if it was Thursdays or Fridays, run down to the comic book store in downtown Springfield, Missouri, you know, take my money that I'd made at McDonald's, my paycheck, allotted a certain amount each week to.
It's legit. You're, like, a legit fan.
Really, yeah, hardcore.
And the X-Men are actually, I mean, I don't know about you, Judy, but I feel like for me that was the big entryway into everything Marvel, right? Mm-hmm. There was like something that everyone could connect with because they were younger, they were getting powers at like a very, you know, specific age, at adolescence and stuff.
I think there's something key about, I mean, even though the first team of the X-Men started in the 60s, I think there's something about the team that came out in the 70s that made them even more approachable and more accessible than even the ones that came before it, because they were diverse. They were far more, even more so, of outcasts. So I think that appealed to a lot of people who read comic books, obviously, you know, in the 70s, 80s, and 90s.
So let's actually talk about New York? Because we mentioned the setting, the urban setting of New York. You obviously have a strong connection to it with all of the work that you've done with your podcast. What is the relationship to comic book stories and New York City and urban settings in general? Why do we always end up there?
Right. Well, there's sort of two ways. There's this sort of external and internal way to go about this. Externally, you know, like I said, this was the heart of the comic book industry almost entirely until the 1970s when sort of major companies began to, like, go to the West Coast and that kind of thing. Internally, in terms of, like, the content of the comic books, because you had all the creators who were here, they were drawing what they knew.
Right.
They were also, you know, they were having to populate, you know, panels. And so you could certainly set it in, you know, a rural farm area, but that's not as interesting to the eye look at as cityscapes, right? Mm-hmm. On top of it, you know, because of the strength of the superhero genre, you need things and people to save.
Right.
And as a result, and especially what Marvel did, what kind of evolved, is not only using a city as a place to, like, have these adventures, but then to use the city itself in the adventures in extraordinary ways. I mean, my number one and most obvious example is Spider-Man, because it's like, well, Spider-Man is not set in rural Kansas, because what would he be swinging on the telephone poles?
Yeah.
That would be the only thing, right?
Oh, yeah.
Part of his dynamic is that he flies to the sky from skyscraper to skyscraper.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, even, you know, their headquarters are in the city, you know, and when they aren't, it's like the X-Men, and they're just up north in Westchester.
Yeah, there's a lot of times where we'll be doing, like, every time we do, like, a Spider-Man story, or if Spider-Man is, like, guest starring somewhere, and we set him somewhere that's not an urban setting, everyone's like, we can't do that. How is he ever going to swing? Like, what is he on, like, telephone poles? Like,
well, yeah, I mean, a really good writer can write around that. But
in farmland, like, I don't know what you're thwipping to.
Right.
Thwipping on a bird, I don't know.
But even, like, the city, by placing it so specifically in an actual city, no diss DC, but placing it in a city that exists, and then placing those people specifically, like GPS, putting them on a map, those characters kind of develop the feeling. Like, for instance, you know, you have Daredevil in Hell's Kitchen, and you have Luke Cage in Harlem, and you have Doctor Strange in the Village. I mean, those settings are reflected in who those characters are.
It is funny now that you read, like, a Daredevil, and I've mentioned this before, but you read it like a Daredevil comic, a Hell's Kitchen thing, and I was reading it, like, obviously maybe last year, a couple years ago, and they make a mention of this little kid running up to Daredevil and be like, "Daredevil, come quick, like, my mom is being mugged on, like, 408 West 48th Street." And meanwhile, I lived on 410 West 48th Street. I was like, this is so weird. I mean, it's such a different time, and Hell's Kitchen is not what it is in Daredevil.
I love that in the TV show they have to kind of, like, preserve a version of the Hell's Kitchen that's both old and new.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I've heard jokes about, like, the number of Thai restaurants, and you see things that, like, you see boutiques in the background, but, like, they still have to have that sort of, like, underworld criminal infrastructure.
Yeah, and
you know?
It's, like, the safest, like, Hell's Kitchen is so, I feel so safe walking as a woman in Hell's Kitchen, mostly because there's, like, so many gay men, and I'm like, oh, my friends are here. Like, it's just, I feel super comfortable.
I mean, I like to think that there's a Jessica Jones and a Daredevil kind of, like, watching out for us, but, you know.
There are.
But there are always stories. They're real.
It's true.
But I feel like in every instance, especially as someone who didn't grow up in New York City in itself is a character of the story. And the character, and, like, if you look back at like the 30s and the 40s, where people were moving more and more to the metropolitan areas, New York was this character that they wanted to move to, or that, so Spider-Man in itself is interacting with the most important character, which is New York City.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So let's talk about that, the podcast and everything. I learned a lot, okay, and I actually did not know as much about the history of, like, newspaper competition and how that really started out.
The beginnings.
Yeah, the beginning of comics as we know it, right? So,
well, it's funny. It's like, it's true evolution. Like, when you get your Sunday paper, they still have them, I assume. You used to get your Sunday paper, it was really big, and there would be a comics section.
Mm-hmm. I love that section. Yeah,
that comics section is the proto comic book, because that's where it came from. It's these, it's the idea of, like, new printing methods, like newspapers could finally print color, mm-hmm. and using that to sort of snag readers in an era when the Gilded Age, when people were making up fake news,
yeah.
like all sorts of different things, anything to get people to buy the newspapers. So that's
really not so different from today.
No.
That's so weird.
No.
Wow.
But then the comic was sort of born out of that. It was, you know, there used to just be illustrations because there were never photographs.
Mm-hmm.
So these newspapers had huge rosters of art teams, and they had relationships with artists. And so that's kind of where it comes into. Like, first, it's sort of like one panels with captions, and then it's a series of panels with captions, and then at some point the speech balloon is introduced.
Mm-hmm.
So, by the 1920s, that is one of the reasons people are buying newspapers at all. And that's why you have these daily pages of comic strips.
So it was for everyone, like kids, adults, like whoever just wanted.
Yeah. And it was the serial nature of them that made them, you wanted to pick up the paper every day. I mean, if you were an adult and you had, and back then New York had so many more papers, but this mm-hmm. is any city in the United States had the same dilemma. You'd have like five papers, but Little Orphan Annie was only in one paper.
Mm.
And you had a child who was like, where's Little Orphan Annie? I need my little, you know, that's going to be one of your reasons for picking that newspaper so you can take it home and you can give it to your kids. But then as comic strips developed, they became a little bit more adult. I mean, granted, they would also, like, kids would read everything, but then you would have comic strip that sort of geared with more mature subjects,
mm-hmm.
meaning like romance and crime or whatever. So it's just amazing to me how that used to be like one of the most important pages of the and revenue generating of newspapers. I mean, we're so, our experience of newspapers now is so different.
Yeah.
I mean, they still have these strips, of course, but so then what happened is then, you know, Sunday's papers were always the biggest anyway. So I think it's in the 1894, 96 or whatever is when the first sort of like supplement in color came out. And so you bought those Sunday papers because you wanted that color supplement.
Mm-hmm.
And then finally someone had a great idea of like, well, if this is so popular, why are we even putting it in the newspaper? Let's just separate it. So then the first comics, the first, what we consider the first comics, famous funnies and more fun, things like that, from the early 30s, are just collected comic strips.
Right.
And then from there, it's like, well, we don't need to all these old comic strips. Let's just make a bunch of new comic strips. So then there'd be comic books that are like still strips forms, but they'd be new. They wouldn't be newspapers.
Yeah.
And so, of course, then that's, as you can see, imagine that evolves into like, why are we just sticking with one like row of panels? Why can't we just do a few pages? And so that's, you know, where the comic book comes from.
So the evolution then from, you know, obviously from strips to strips in books essentially, and then to comics, how do we get from there to, I guess, the superhero world?
Right. Well, there are a lot of theories where kind of Superman came from. My personal opinion is Superman is not the first superhero, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I think I said this on my show. I think Popeye is the first superhero.
Yeah, definitely.
Because he gets superpowers when something happens to him.
Mm-hmm.
It's just like the Hulk.
Yeah.
Except healthier.
Yeah.
You know? But essentially, he, to me, is the first superhero. But, I mean, there's a lot of kind of reasons you know, more intellectual reasons as to why superheroes came to be. A lot of it has to do with the Great Depression mm-hmm. and wanting to see kind of like superheroic activities because things were so gloomy and whatever.
Right.
Whatever happened, it was really like Superman gave birth to it, because had that been a total flop,
mm-hmm.
I mean, it would have just stunted the growth of the... I mean, superheroes might have still been popular later, but it's kind of a lucky guess, because Superman had just been sort of a lame, like, uninspiring and poorly produced.
Yeah.
That may have been pushed things back a little bit. But because Superman was such a big hit, people just wanted to literally copy it. And so the first superheroes that came out were just, like, Superman carbon copies, almost. I mean, you didn't even get... like, Batman was just a few years later. I don't know exactly. I'm not even sure when the first female superhero came along, but it would have been, you know, a few years later, because it just would have been perhaps, like, they wouldn't have perhaps even thought of it.
Yeah, around this era. Was it Wonder Woman?
I don't actually know.
She's definitely the first, but...
We had Hellcat. So Ruth Atkinson was a comics creator back in the day. She's one of the first female comics creator with Marvel. She created Hellcat, and I think that was like in the 1940s, late
1940s. Timely had a female character that was like similar to Captain America during World War II.
Yeah, so that was, I'm pretty sure that was Miss America.
Yeah.
Yeah, the first Miss America. Right. Yeah, oh my gosh,
that's just flashing before my eyes. Yeah. I used to have, obviously being a comic geek, I would always also buy the comic book buyer's guide, that big thing.
Yeah.
So I mean, all of these, I'm like, oh, Miss America.
Yeah.
I think you're right. I think she was the first.
Yes, her and then Hellcat maybe came around the same time or a couple years after that. But it is, and they're very different iterations of those characters today, as we've imagined it. As you guys might know, Miss America is now America Chavez.
Oh, yeah.
Yes, we do not call her Miss America. We just call her America.
But what I think is so interesting about comics is even from the beginning, they were sort of political. Like, you mm-hmm. think about the political comics, and then you think about, obviously, the next step for superheroes, which was World War II, and how, you know, I wonder if superhero comics would have continued in their explosion if World War II hadn't happened and there wasn't suddenly these big bad guys that they could use. Like, you think about the first cover of Captain America, he's punching Hitler.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, and even kind of prove that point further, I think, then after the war, superheroes kind of die off mm-hmm. a little bit. Like, they're not as popular. Only a few of them kind of survive. That's how we separate the golden and the silver age. But, you know, or maybe like not having those foes so obviously sort of placed, like having like absolute pure evil and enemies in the real world reflected well on comic books, and when those were sort of quote unquote gone, but not really, maybe people like turned to other things to kind of like soothe their souls, I think.
Yeah, and they got like Joe Simon, Jack Kirby, like they got death threats.
Yes.
Right? Mm-hmm. Which I did not know about until I listened to your podcast. I was
So Timely's office was down at the McGraw-Hill building. It would, of course, later move to Empire State Building. I mean, talk about, like, you don't get more, like, New York than having your office in the Empire State Building.
Yeah.
But when they did those sort of wartime comic books with the Human Torch and Captain America and Bucky and all of that, they were, like flat out political, and this was a city that was quite diverse at the time, and mm-hmm. we had a big German population here, and they didn't like the characterization of themselves mm-hmm. in these. And then, of course, you did have, you know, you had radicals in the city. I mean, you did have, you know, you really did have people who were Nazis who lived in New York, or Nazi sympathizers. And so, yeah, they would get death threats. And what would, of course, make that even more striking is that most of the creators were Jewish mm-hmm. or from Jewish backgrounds and mm-hmm. were mostly all born in New York. So that's really frightening. And as I recount in the podcast, and I think I even, there was like a whole newspaper article on this. I have to look it up. But yeah, Mayor Fiorello LaGuardia actually just called them up and said, don't worry, we're taking care of you, we're protecting you. And so we'd have police protection outside.
That's so crazy. We've gotten death threats before too. It's any time that you do anything kind of crazy or political or seemingly political or change a character, we get some terrible responses.
Well, I like that that Marvel's doing that right now in a way that I think is even more bold than what they did back then.
Yeah, oh yeah.
Because it's infiltrating the characters themselves. I mean, back then it would be the characters fighting some sort of ill of the world, but now the characters kind of represent this greater diversity and a greater number of points of view, I think. So, yeah, I mean, that's a good tradition to keep holding, I think.
Well, I find it interesting that, like, comics have created such controversy, like, over the... And this is... It creates controversy now. It has created it, really, since the inception. And, you know, speaking... And you spoke a little bit about the Comics Code Authority and sort of that whole debacle. And you had some really great clips in their podcast about, like, Dr. Wortham, who was, like, a strong advocate against, like, horror comics. And was it Superman? Like, he just was very anti-comic. I thought it was... fascinating. What was going on there?
Like, all right, so there was this this man named Dr. Frederick Wortham, who you know, was a noted psychologist scholar who had written this book called The Seduction of the Innocent. And in it sort of outlined how evil and how morally repugnant comic books are and how they needed to be abolished and how they were ruining our children. Now, I'm not going to give him any credit, but at the same time, you have EC Comics, which was formerly Educational Comics, but had now been taken over by the flamboyant William Gaines, who was producing Tales from the Crypt and all of these extremely vivid, beautiful comic books, classics, but like nasty, this like kind of horrific things happening, and you know, and that was super appealing if you were a kid and you wanted to buy that. But those, you know, we're talking in the 1950s, like nothing was gory, like films weren't gory, you know, so you could, you, that was how, like, to be able to have that kind of access would have been insane. So, you know, also keep in mind that this is, you know, we're McCarthy era here. It's anti-communist. So comic books are being drawn into this conversation. In my opinion, it's because they were an easy target. Because there was a lot of things that they could have gone after. But, I mean, and also, I think that because comic books were also... a lot of Jewish creators. I think there was a lot of that going on too, that like, well, look at these horrible things that they're, you know, that they're producing, these, you know, these ethnic people. So it all came to a head with Seduction of the Innocent. And they had so then they had court trials. I mean, they had trials in downtown New York where Wortham would testify about how horrible all these creations were, and the clip in that is just one of a number of outrageous, like, overly sensitive things. By the way, all of the you can listen to all of us, because they were broadcast live on WNYC, so they have all of them online. If anyone wants to listen, go down the rabbit hole of like these characters, these crazy people talking about this. So he, you know, in particular in the Superman clip, you know, he was like psychoanalyzing why children were going to be damaged by watching a superhero save people's lives. You know,
which is just so crazy to me, because like we think about superheroes now and like how it's really great for children and like all the ideals they represents and whatnot, but he had taken like the flips up, like the flip of that, and saying they're looking up to this fake creature versus their parents, which I thought was hilarious.
Well, I just actually finished this book called Flappers, and it talks about a lot about like how we went from Victorian to the super open-mindedness of the 20s, and then immediately receded back into the idea of the Victorian age. And after reading that, I look back at the 30s and the 40s, and that's obviously where that comes from, especially at the end of World War II, when women are now working more prevalently, more than ever before, and the men come back. They want their jobs back.
Oh, yeah. They're seen as a threat because they may go into an office and there's been a woman working there for 4 years in a similar position. Absolutely.
Well, let's talk about ladies in comics. you spoke a little bit about a writer who is a I guess one of the first female writers in the industry. And so what is really the history of comics and women and female comics creators specifically?
Well, the thing is, there have always been women creators.
Thank you.
Always.
Thank you for saying that. I was just actually hoping that you would say that, because that is the myth that we always like to debunk here.
Yeah. Well, no, I mean, it's... The moment you kind of look into it, it's not surprising, because a lot of women were illustrators. A lot of them had fashion backgrounds, actually. Like, I think you'll find more than a few that even had, like, studied or got degrees at FIT, for instance, which I think is a really interesting comparison, because, of course, you know, that would have been... That's a natural progression.
Right.
Or they may not... They might say digression, but I think it's a progression into doing comic books. But... The interesting thing is I think they're sort of hidden, especially when you talk about the 30s, 40s, and 50s. And my wish is that one day Marvel Comics would produce a television show about timely comics, and because a comic book office back then would have been a little bit like Mad Men. Was, you know, in the 60s. In fact, a lot of comic creators were also ad guys, so it wouldn't be surprising. And also the bullpen kind of office layout would have been sort of the same. So, you know, you would have had female writers, artists, colorists, inkists, all these, every profession, but I think in a work environment that would have been needless to say quite challenging for them. So, a lot of the women I think are sort of unsung heroes. And for instance, I have a list of them on my phone but essentially they were like editors.
Yeah.
And a lot of times the men would often get the credit, but they would be like, I can't remember her name, but the co-creator of Kryptonite over at DC was a woman. Like, there were a lot of sort of like significant characters in the DC and Marvel universes that are created by women.
Yeah.
But then what happens is they'll get kind of reinterpreted by men. And so I think a lot of the sort of the nuance that would have made them kind of original characters kind of changes. Now, you give me the background on this, but I just found out, again, I'm blanking on her name, the creator of Tigra.
Mm-hmm.
Before she, it was called The Cat, and it was 1972 or 1974. And what was interesting is Marvel had an all women crew to make, you know, writer artists and everything else to create it. And it didn't. I don't think it did very well. But then that character then became Tigra.
Yes.
Which is kind of a very different kind of character than I think perhaps a woman in the early 70s would have created.
Yeah, because I think a man took that over
and put her in a bikini.
Yeah. I feel like there was actually... When did that... The Cat was around the 70s?
I think it... I want to say...
Around the 70s? Yeah.
Early 70s, 1972 or 4. The two dates that are sticking in my head. Anyway, it's fascinating... though, because and you would have throughout comic book history these like efforts to bring women in to the creative process. A lot of times, though, especially in the mid-century, it was to produce comics that would appeal to girls.
Mm-hmm.
So, as we mentioned, like after the war, for a variety of different reasons, like superhero comics just weren't as popular anymore, and so everyone wanted to do Western comic books and horror comic books, and then romance comic books were huge, which I find like extraordinary.
Yeah.
And that's where, isn't that where Patsy Walker comes from?
Yeah,
isn't that her background?
Yeah, so Patsy Walker was created by, as I mentioned, Ruth Atkinson. Patsy Walker is Hellcat, and was created around the 1940s. But it was through sort of this it was Patsy Walker Hellcat, and then also Millie the Model. So it was like this series of comics that were a little bit more very very girl friendly, but very much leaning on like romance storylines and, you know, things that girls that would resonate with young women and with girls. And when we were talking to Trina Robbins, actually, she talked a lot about that. Is that they had actually, back in the day when she was collecting comics, they actually had female characters on the covers, but it was a lot more female friendly and something that she gravitated towards. And then those just kind of slowly went away. And so as those went away, the women went away. We just didn't have as many people reading those comics.
I find that so weird because why couldn't Night Nurse have had powers back then? Or why couldn't, you know, there's all of these. It was like giving women powers would have been, but not sexualizing them.
Right.
Because, of course, you had female superheroes, but they were all in like tight-fitting bodices.
Sure.
These others that were sort of normal women didn't have superpowers, and they weren't in super-powered scenarios. And so by the time the 60s came around and you did get women superheroes, they were just derivatives initially of men.
Yeah. And if they didn't have powers, they were just sort of in support of.
They were like need to be saved by. I mean, Trina talks about how she deviated from comics because the woman on the cover after at the end of the romance era was the woman needing to be saved. They're defenseless. Mm-hmm. They're weak. And as a woman, and I even she was like, we asked her like, did you realize what you stopped buying those? And she said no. And I think that is like the moment when women were like, we want comics where women are not needing to be saved.
Yeah.
Especially in the 1960s and 1970s.
Right. Because women don't want to see themselves as, one, the cause of a lot of trouble and problems. We're like, oh, I guess I, you know, got kidnapped by the bad guy again because I'm an idiot.
Yeah.
Guy has to go save me. I'm falling off a bridge again.
Uh-oh.
I mean, you would even have, like, seeing early plots, plots with Jean Grey or, you know, Sue Richards are kind of amusing because they're still in a sort of 1960s mold, and they're often doing housewife things on top of powers, which today sounds pretty awesome, like she can do everything, but back then it was sort of kind of relegated into a slot. But way back to Patricia Highsmith, who was the woman you were alluding to, who was I'd say she's not the best known in terms of her work in comic books. She's the best known in terms of, like, she then became a novelist and Talented Mr. Ripley and the story that gave us Carol is, you know, is Patricia Highsmith. She's an amazing writer. So she worked for Timely in the 40s, and she worked through this transition. She worked on superhero comic books, and then she worked on romance comic books. Mm-hmm. And I think she followed Timely from McGraw-Hill into the Empire State Building.
Oh, that's interesting. Well, we actually have just a special shout out to things that we've worked on in the past. We created an anthology called Girl Comics, and it's a great anthology of a bunch of different female creators. And at the time, we didn't even have as many female-led titles or female creators. But what's great is that we have a bunch of special spotlights of female creators in the past, I would say since the inception of Marvel. So Marvel female creators and a little bit of history and background as to what they worked on, who they were, and some really great pictures that I was able to uncover, do some very special digging. Yes, I will share them with you. You should definitely check it out. And my favorite, of course, was, you know, fast-forwarding through all of the different, like, women in comics, people like, obviously, June Tarp Mills and Valerie Barclay, and then Marie Severin, who Marie Severin was a very, like, prolific creator, and people just never really know. But if you open up a comic book from like the 60s, there's a good chance you're going to see Marie Severin's name next to penciler, inker, or colorist. So you spoke a little bit about Marie in your podcast at all, or no?
Well, no, just in terms of EC Comics, they were located, again, it's back to like everything is like so You could just find it on a map in New York City, the history of comic books. They were located in an office in the area of, like, Little Italy today, in Petrosino Square. And I can't remember if it was her. It was another woman who worked for them in the office. And the office got raided. This wasn't in the show, actually. I cut this part, but it's so interesting because they actually got raided for producing scandalous, obscene comic books by the New York Police Department.
No way.
And were located two blocks away. But apparently was like at lunch, like whatever they, like, if they were having martini lunches or whatever, but she was the only one there, and so she had to, like, field them or whatever. But
I love this vision that you have of comics offices back in the day. It's very, everyone's
they're
super
just drinking
classy.
Martinis.
And it's very Mad Men.
I know it's not really like a Mad Men.
No, that's how I'm picturing it now from now on.
I want it to be a little bit, I'm sure it's a little bit, you know, not as exquisite. But, she, again, I think with a lot of women creators back then, they are everywhere, and they are in every era, but it's sort of low key.
Very low key, yeah. When I was talking to Marie, I got to actually interview her on the phone, and it was so hard to get in touch with her, and she was, you know, much older, and sort of, she's had some health problems, but she was, like, very lucid when she was talking about her experiences at Marvel. And my biggest question was, you know, and she sort of evolved, like, through the bullpen, and, you know, she got sort of a small little gig and then ended up becoming one of their prominent pencilers there. But what I thought was interesting, where I was like, you know, like, did you feel like you were the only woman? Like, did that ever kind of, did you internalize that and how to deal with that fact? And she's like, no, she's like, I feel like, you know, half the time I wanted to, like, you know, throttle them, and half the time we were, like, joking around, and it was totally normal. And it's just interesting, like, how, like, she has no idea how big of a role that she had and how much she impacted comics in that way. Like, she was experiencing it.
I mean, I think it's because those particular roles in the era would have appealed to certain kind of people who are just like, you know what, I want to draw, this is my talent, I'll just put up with this. Yeah. I mean, I'm sure the sexism that she had to put up with, I'm sure she had to put up with things like people being promoted over her. I mean, I'm sure all of this happened, and she just had a love for drawing. Mm-hmm. And she's just like, this is, you know, what I want to do.
Well, I feel like most important female and every person that is, like, important to a movement, you know, who sat down on a bus, whatever, like, they were just doing what they were doing. Yeah. They didn't realize until after they took a step back. I think it's so interesting. I'm sure Sana's been asked this before. Like, sometimes we do this panel at San Diego New York Comic Con. Now it's a regular occurrence, and it's a great time. But in the beginning, when we first started doing it, people would always ask us, do you feel like you are, you know, that you're a woman and that you're singled out? And, like, I've never in my moment ever felt that. And I don't think I think Marvel's always been so great to people, and we have tons of women here that have worked here for a substantial amount of time, 20, 30 years, and that, you know, may even remember the Empire State Building.
I mean, I'm glad now that I just have, like, my fellow dude employees being, like, asking my opinion about things and being aware of the fact that they might not have the answer to it. So I'm cool with it. Last kind of closing question. Yeah. You know, you've seen so much about the evolution of comics in relation to the history of New York City and whatnot. Like, one, obviously, how do you feel about where comics is now? And where do you think, you know, is there a next chapter? Do you think that there is an evolution coming, or did we do it all?
Well, I mean, it's funny because, I mean, in a way, it's like, the dream, the world that I wished to live in when I was young, and I was like, I was 24/7 comic books, is happening now, because it's like, oh, it's kind of 24/7 comic books everywhere. Mm-hmm. Like, I turn on the TV and it's Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. and I go to the movies and it's Doctor Strange and I do this, I do this, and I do this. And I think it's fabulous, obviously. And I also think that the acceptance of comic books, I think, is overall a good thing.
Yeah.
I do think and I'm sure that you have all had like millions of meetings about this kind of thing, where I just don't want to see a world where comics become beside the point,
right?
Where you're generating like creations for the purpose of this thing over here.
Sure.
And I think that luckily it sounds like, at least from pretty much every comic book creator that I've talked to, that there's a real, like, that is an, that is, everyone is very hyper aware mm-hmm. of that, and to create a balance is really key. So, you know, I think that, no, I think it's fantastic. I would personally, I'm talking to the right people, I personally think that comic books should be even greater, more largely accepted, and you know, I don't know what those steps are to even like to to make them as accessible or you know, as popular as just a magazine, like regular magazine.
Yeah.
You
yeah.
know, you know, it drives me nuts when I go to like the Barnes and Noble, and I'm like, here's all of the regular magazines, and oh, the comic books are kind of shunted over here on the side.
Yeah.
And because comic books can be for everyone, mm-hmm. and now more than ever, there are more comic books are for many different kind of people, and so I think that there are still barriers to access for, I think a lot of people are now see brand new comic book stereotypes. Before, they might have just seen them as geeks. Now maybe they just see them as like, oh, movie masculine type things. Mm-hmm. And I think the challenge going forward is to further reflect that comic books are for everyone, and comic books aren't just superheroes. Comic books, and if they are superheroes, they're not just the same superheroes that you know of and how they're presented. So.
Yeah. And this is a good time to call out the fact that there are different ways to access comics, like mm-hmm. Marvel Unlimited and Comixology yes. and the Marvel Comics app, and also definitely go and support your local comic shop retailer. The biggest question that we always get is like, where's our comic shop? There's something called comicbooklocator.com where you can find your local comic shop, or just Google Maps. It's really easy. Just put comic shop on it. These are really mom and pop shops. They love what they do. They put their heart and soul into it. And you are supporting a local business when you support local comics. And you also get a really, really beautiful comic book that ends up being a collector yeah. item and or some other things that you want to collect, like toys and action figures and whatnot. So if you guys are interested in reading comics for the first time or just supporting your local business, go check it out. It's always a fun experience, and talking to the mm-hmm. comic shop owners who also have such a great sense of history,
right?
And know about the industry, but also just about you know having been in their local town for so long and growing alongside with it.
We're so lucky to live in, like, we all grew up in an era where comic book stores existed. And they're like my most treasured memories of me going to, and they would always be like the weirdest places. Like a weird strip mall that used to be like a dentist office. Mm-hmm. I mean, they were like the tables would even still be there. They have the table, you know. So there's just a wonderful experience going, like, the comic book store to me is like a place of pure joy.
Yeah.
Actually. So, but, you know, like you said, that's only one way to get comic books. You can get them, digitally. They are so beautiful to mm-hmm. look at.
Yes,
you
know? Yes.
Just whip a few out on your big, you know, huge screen yeah. at home and just get lost in them, and they're gorgeous.
Yeah, that's actually how the colors and actually make comics these days. So, anyway, this has been so great. I didn't even realize what time it is. It's like gone so quickly because I've enjoyed speaking with you so awesome. Much.
Well, I'm going to go back out in the street now, where it's St. Patty's Day in New York City.
Best of luck and Godspeed. And where can people find out? Obviously, Barry Boy's podcast. This particular episode, I believe it's episode 187.
Yeah, you can go to. Well, if you, I say iTunes, but you can wherever you get your podcast. podcasts, because it's not just iTunes anymore. There's several different places. But you can find all of our back catalog, most of our back catalog there, up until like 100 shows, whatever. But this is definitely there. I also think that I would like to recommend our spinoff podcast called The First Stories of Invention and Their Consequences, because I think that there's would be a lot of crossover. My last episode was on so each episode is about like the first something. Mm-hmm. So it's usually technology, but doesn't have to be. The last episode was of the first robot, the first robotic arm. They usually have some tie into sort of modern times because, you know, taking jobs, robotic arms. But then like the newest one right now is about the very first elephant that was ever in the United States. So anyway,
that sounds awesome.
So yeah. that is in the same place as the Bowery Boys.
And what about where they can find you on the internet?
BoweryBoysHistory.com is our website. And then if we're on Facebook and on Twitter at Bowery Boys.
Fantastic.
Cool.
Well,
it's been an honor being here.
Yeah, so I wish we could talk forever.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And hopefully you guys will check out the awesome podcast that we referenced so much, and we didn't even give you that much of it as well.
Yeah.
My name is Leah Williams, writer of Totally Awesome Hulk, number one MU backup. And my favorite female superhero is Emma Frost, because no matter where she is, she's always going to be the smartest person in the room, since she can telepathically crowdsource information.
Hello, this is Brandon Montclair, writer for Moon Girl and Devil Dinosaur, which I hope is one of your favorite comic books. One of my favorite Marvel female superheroes is Kitty Pryde. I could have just as easily picked She-Hulk or Tigra or Kamala Khan, but I'm going to stick with Kitty Pryde because she always seems to bring out the best in all the creators that work on her. Great stories from her being the kid sister of the X-Men to leadership roles in the Marvel Universe. Always the best stories and the coolest character.
Hi, I'm Russell Dauterman, artist of The Mighty Thor. If you'd asked me a few years ago who my favorite female superhero was, I easily would have said the X-Men women, Storm, Rogue, Jean Grey. They'd been my favorite super anyone since I was 7 years old, and I still think they're awesome, but my favorites changed since working on the Jane Foster Thor books. I've been thinking more and more about what it means to be a hero and the sacrifice involved, and Jane's commitment to uphold the mantle of Thor and fight for others, despite struggling with breast cancer and the complications being Thor is having on that. I just think she really embodies what being a hero is. And she says stuff like, "So begins the kicking of thine hindquarters." So I hope it's not too corny to say the character I work on is my favorite, but she is.
Hi, I'm Ryan North. I'm the writer on The Unbeatable Squirrel Girl. And my favorite female superhero, besides Squirrel Girl, obviously, who is clearly awesome, is She-Hulk. What I love about Jennifer is she has, obviously, this great power, physical strength, but she also is super competent. She is a lawyer. She knows her way around all sorts of problems. She can punch her way out of problems. She can lawyer her way out of problems. And it makes for some really interesting stories and a very interesting character. So let's say She-Hulk and Squirrel Girl are tied for first.
Hey friends, Tana here, artist on Marvel Silk, with my pick for favorite female superhero. As obvious as this might seem, my choice is Cindy Moon. Cindy is tough and clever. She's super strong and super fast, thanks to that radioactive spider bite. And best of all, she spins webs out of her fingertips. Talk about a costume change on the go. And I like that Cindy Moon is not perfect. She's awkward sometimes. She's damaged, and that seems real to me. Silk struggles to understand her conflicting feelings of isolation and abandonment, and what it means for her to be heroic. We watch her try and unpack these things on the page with Dr. Sinclair, her therapist, and to a lesser degree with J. Jonah Jameson, who only knows her as Cindy Moon, but becomes her stalwart defender anyway, her loudmouth champion. I like that Cindy Moon has these friendships. I like that Cindy Moon is a loyal friend. Her two best friends in the whole world are Lola and Rafferty, lesbians who are in an interracial, healthy relationship. These women have all gone on adventures together, saved each other from danger, they look out for one another, they take care of one another, and they always remember to bring bubble tea back for everyone. Cindy Moon Silk is the kind of superhero that I needed when I was growing up. I think that that is why drawing these comic books now is so meaningful for me. Cindy is imperfect, but hardworking. Her friends don't always understand her. Gwen Stacy can be downright mean. Check out the Spider-Woman crossover event if you want details on that. But Silk flourishes when Mockingbird takes her under her wing. And I love that. I like a character that can grow, that can become her best self. So, in honor of Women's History Month, my pick for favorite female superhero is undoubtedly Silk. Thanks so much for having me on. I love the Women of Marvel podcast. And have a great Women's History Month, you guys. Tana out.
Okay, so that was a packed-filled podcast. It was super long, super amazing to produce. We were so excited to bring our loves of history and Women's History Month to the podcast.
And that was just part one.
Yeah.
Right? We haven't even gotten to part two yet.
Yes.
So hopefully you guys enjoyed that. We wanted to make this feel like a special celebration. Yes, of all of the accomplishments that, of course, we've been able to do as the Women of Marvel, but also just across the board, women in comics across time, and wanted to shed some light on actually what was going on. So hopefully you guys enjoyed the great interviews that we had. Sorry, we brought a dude on the podcast. Oops.
But man, I fangirled real hard, so I'm okay with that.
Yes, that was a great conversation, Greg. I learned so much during the course of like that conversation and listening to his podcast that I did not know. So I hopefully you guys will also appreciate that.
Yeah, and we're looking to do sort of more of these larger podcasts throughout the year. Stay tuned for our next one, which will come in the summer, which is all about gaming and women in gaming. So we're really excited to produce that. So tune in next week. We're going to have a roundtable discussion about today's podcast. And as always, if you have questions or suggestions, please email us at womanof@marvel.com or tweet at Marvel with hashtag Woman of Marvel. We'll see you guys next week. This is Marvel, your universe.